Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, tax season is on the horizon, and changes in state and federal tax laws may have some effect on you. We're talking about tax filing preparation on the show with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals. They consult other tax tax professionals, teach tax seminars around the country. Always great to have Mary stop by. And as we visit with her, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about questions you have about filing your taxes. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Thank you for joining us again.
You're welcome.
Oh, man. Well, here, let's see. In 2024, taxpayers in 12 states were able to file their taxes electronically for free directly with the IRS. And starting in January of 2025, direct file will be available in 24 states, including Wisconsin. Is this program widely known by taxpayers?
I don't think so. The IRS has provided kind of free services. There is a VITA program that was for low-income people, and that's been going on for a very long time. In addition, IRS had something called FreeFile, which was a collaboration with software, tax software developers, and they provided the ability to FreeFile through the IRS, through the IRS website, and then it directed you to these other companies. And it was for a set group of people based on your financial situation. That program seemingly is coming to an end, and Congress forced IRS to create their own software to do online tax returns.
Okay.
Who's it's been that? Around, yeah. Go ahead. But not in the same vehicle that it currently is.
Okay. Who's eligible to use this IRS direct file?
Well, it is based on the type of income that goes on your tax return, not necessarily that you have to be low income or high income people are left out. But there are specific types of income that you would have. W-2 income, Social Security, unemployment, interest, retirement, and for people in Alaska, their Alaska Permanent Fund dividends. So it's not open to everybody. Let's put it that way. So if you're in a small business, you do Uber, you know, you do babysitting, you do something that's self-employed, this program's not available to you.
Yeah. I saw there were several, I think 29 Republican Congress members sent a letter to President-elect Trump to urge him to end this program on his first day in office. Why do they want to end it?
I don't know. I can tell you one thing. It costs the government $26 million, I believe, to set up this program and operate it. So that's a big chunk out of the federal budget to do tax returns free for people.
Yeah. I guess
that would be my thought. Not knowing their reasoning, but it's a large amount of money for IRS to do that, and they have to take resources from another place to do that.
Yeah. Larry in Rice Lake has a question for us already, so let's go there. Larry, hello.
Good morning. My question is regarding HSAs and specifically taking a one-time HSA rollover from an IRA, how that works, and what's the difference between that and simply withdrawing from your IRA, paying the taxes, and then depositing some of that money you've withdrawn into your HSA at your local institution and figuring that on your taxes?
Good question, Larry. First of all, I think HSAs are wonderful programs. And an HSA, the downside to it is that to participate in an HSA health savings account, you have to have a high deductible HSA qualified plan. And I'm assuming that you do that, that you have that. And so first step is, if you have that kind of health insurance, you're able to set up an HSA account. The HSA account is money deposit into the account, and you get to take a deduction for that money deposited into account. There is a set dollar amount for it based on family plan or based on single coverage or based on family coverage. What you're talking about as far as the rollover is concerned, you are able to take money out of your IRA, I believe it's a one-time rollover, and put it into the HSA, and the max amount that you can do that with is the maximum IRA HSA contribution for the year. The advantage of it is that it goes streamline. You don't have any distribution from the IRA, any income from that. You don't have any HSA contribution. It's kind of like a wash. You're going from one non-taxable account to another non-taxable account, if you will. If you do, as you propose, take the money out of the IRA and then put it into the HSA, the problem that you will have there is you could be subject to the 10% penalty depending on your age. If you are under 59 and a half, then taking money out of your IRA is going to be a 10% penalty unless you meet another exception. The income is going to be a wash. You put the income in, you take the deduction for the HSA, but it's the 10% penalty that potentially could be the difference for you.
Yeah, that's could be a large amount of money. Larry, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. It reminded me about another issue. More people are withdrawing money from their retirement savings to pay for financial emergencies, for example. But these withdrawals are subject to tax penalties, aren't they?
Correct. Yes. This year, there are two new penalty exceptions that are available for people who take early withdrawals from their pension or their IRA. One of them is for a family emergency. The downside of it is the maximum you can get out of it is $1,000. And further downside is that locks you out of doing it for the next 3 years.
Oh.
So it's a nice thought. Personally, don't think the dollar amount is as large as it should be if you're talking about an emergency.
Yeah, for sure. And I had, I was just reading something in the Post maybe a month ago about somebody who had withdrawn in a financial scam and had a couple hundred thousand dollars she took out, and now she's subject to the tax on that, even after she lost all of her money.
Right, because the money you take out, once you take it out, it comes through on a 1099-R with a special code on, and early withdrawals are code 1, which means the entire withdrawal is subject to a 10% penalty unless you can come up with one of the 23 exceptions that the IRS provides.
Wow. Joseph in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Joseph.
Hello. taking the call. I just have a question. So I just turned 70 in October. I've got a 401k at my work. I'm going to retire in April. I heard that I need to start taking money out of my 401k. Is that true?
No. You will need to take money out. Now, you may need to take money out to live on it, but that's a separate issue. What I believe you're talking about is a required minimum distribution, otherwise known as RMD. Your age for RMD used to be 70 and a half. Then it was changed to 72, and currently it's age 73. So by age 73, the year that you turn age 73, you must start taking money out of that account. Prior to that, you are not required to take it out.
All right. There you go, Joseph. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You could join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. In either case, we'll get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk taxes with our guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband, David, own Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. And certainly, if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And we'll get you on pretty quickly. Mary, college tuition keeps rising. Fortunately, changes were also made to the 529 college savings plan. Tell us about those.
Well, the 529 plan is a plan that you can put money away, and generally it's the gift tax exclusion amount that people put in up to that amount without gift tax requirements. Wisconsin is a little bit different, and they have what's called an EdVest account. And you have a maximum contribution into the EdVest account. I haven't seen this year's numbers for sure, but it's around $3,500, $3,800. And that amount is deductible on the Wisconsin return. So if you do the EdVest program for Wisconsin, you get a deduction there. What's changed this year is the ability to use the funds in the in the 529 plan in a different way. The 529 plan is a wonderful place, especially for grandparents, to put money for their grandchildren. But some people are reluctant to do that because they say, well, I don't know if they're going to go to college. Well, what's new this year is the opportunity to roll that money into a Roth IRA. And there are specifications. The account has to be open for at least 15 years and things like that. But if you start with an account for a child who's young, maybe a newborn or a young child, by the time they're ready to use it or not use it, 15 years has gone by. And this is a one-time ability to roll that money into a Roth IRA. And so it kind of allows that money to be used without tax consequences for the beneficiary. So if they're not going to college, you're giving them a retirement account.
A really pretty good deal. We were fortunate to be able to put money in a 529 account when daughter Emily was born, and it have made an unbelievable difference by the time she was 18 and ready to start college, for sure. And then to have this advantage is really, really something.
A couple of years ago, they added on the ability to take up to $10,000 out of the 529 to pay off student loans. So that also gave an alternative use to it. But this one is great for people who have been saving for college and their beneficiary decides that's not the way to go.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Ed in Beaver Dam, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ed.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, the gentleman earlier mentioned minimum distribution, RMD, but I'm sorry, the time, the age, which I didn't know changed to 73. But my question is, what's the minimum amount? Is there a percentage, or how's that work?
Good question. The RMD minimum amount is defined by the account balance, whether it's your IRA, and IRAs and pension plans are separate. They're a calculation for each one. But you take the account balance at the end of the prior year, and you take a factor that comes from a special table that is equivalent to your age at the end of the year you're taking it out. So it's basically in the first year, in the year you turn 73, the account factor, I believe, is 26.4. So assuming it's 26.4, if you have $1 million in your account at that point, or whatever it is, you take the $1 million, the balance at the end of the prior year, you're required to take it out in 24, you divide it by the 26.4 or whatever the appropriate account number is for your age, and that will give you your answer. Now, just out of knowing the number, if you have $1 million in it and your factor is 26.4, that comes up to about $37,000. If you have half that, it would be half that number. But there is a specific formula for determining it.
And that, I think as you get older, doesn't that percentage...
The factor goes down.
It goes down.
So okay. Theoretically, by about age 105, it's all supposed to be out of there. Theoretically.
Okay. Well, if I ever made it to 105, I guess I probably wouldn't be too concerned about it anymore by that time.
Yeah, that's it. But usually the custodian of the account, be it an IRA or a pension, will do the calculation for you. Oftentimes when you get your brokerage statement from that account, it will have that number towards the end of the year.
Yeah. Jerry emailed, it relates to the same thing, and I think we may have answered it, but let me read it anyway. If you're required to take a minimum distribution at 73, if you have been withdrawing from your account for several years already. So maybe that person had been under the earlier rules.
It could be. What the calculation is the same if it's your money, as opposed to an inherited IRA. But the calculation is take the account balance, which would have decreased as you're taking out money each year, but it's the account balance at the end of the prior year divided by the factor, and IRS has a minimum distribution table, and that factor goes along with the age at the end of the year you're taking it out.
Got it. Bill emailed, he has a friend who collected an inheritance recently. He used some of the money on some home improvement projects, but said he had to pay taxes on the money he used that he was surprised by. Should he have done something differently than he did?
Well, inheritance is a good topic to talk about because there's mixed information. Many times when you inherit something, there is no tax consequences to it. But there is something in inheritance called income in income in respect of a decedent. It's money that the decedent would have had to pay taxes on had they received it, i.e., if you receive their retirement account, IRA or pension plan, that's called income in respect of a decedent. It would have been taxable to the deceased if they had lived. It's taxable to the recipient in their place, so to speak. So I'm guessing what he inherited was probably a retirement account or an annuity or something like that that fits that category. And other than the timing of taking it out, it's going to be taxable.
Okay. John has a $100,000 fully paid up life policy that he can now draw $100,000, take the money. Is he going to be required to pay taxes on that $100,000 that he's paid on over whatever, how many years?
The way life insurance works, it's not considered an investment. However, life insurance does get interest, it gets add-ons if it's a whole life policy, that kind of thing. What you end up paying taxes on is the amount you receive over the cost of the insurance that you've put into it over your life. So the insurance premiums give you a cost basis to use against that distribution that you're going to get. And if you cash in the life insurance policy, and you get back more than you've paid in, the difference is taxable.
Got it. Richard, go ahead.
Let's back for just a minute because someone might be confused. If you are the beneficiary of a life insurance, somebody else dies, the life insurance is on their name, and you inherit it, it is not taxable, except if that policy were sitting somewhere in earned interest before it was given out, there might be some interest attached to it, which is usually a small amount. But receiving the benefits of a life insurance policy as the beneficiary is not taxable. Cashing it in could be.
Richard emailed, he recently paid off his mortgage, which is a good thing, but he liked his lender putting the property tax money in escrow. Any specific way you recommend of putting aside property tax money during the year to avoid being slammed by the tax bill at year's end?
That's kind of a savings question. If Richard happens to be working, maybe his employer would take an automatic distribution into an account, and he could set up his own escrow account, so to speak, by taking the money directly from a paycheck so you wouldn't miss it, and then it would be there.
Pat in Deerfield emailed to ask if the free IRS filing program is the free IRS filing program available for 2024 tax year, and is there a Wisconsin free filing program for the 2024 tax year?
The direct file that we were earlier talking about is available for 2024 on the federal level, and I would encourage people to go to the IRS, type in direct file, because you'll get the information about how you have to log into it, how you have to set up an what's called an ID.me account, so that you can verify your identity so there's not identity theft involved with it. Again, I gave you the income limitation or the income items. There are also some credits that are available, and if you have credits outside of those that are available, you wouldn't be able to use it. But you first have to determine your eligibility to use it. Yes, there are states that are going along with it. I believe Wisconsin is going along with it. I'm not sure if there's any special things that you have to do on Wisconsin, but I suspect that it may be as simple as doing it through the federal and covering both bases. As far as Wisconsin, they've had a free file program for years through the Wisconsin website. That would be different than this, but if they integrated into this program, then you may be able to do it one-stop shopping.
Oh, makes sense. Mary Mellum, our guest today, taking a look at your taxes, and if you have questions about them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. And if you call, we'll get you on pretty quickly here. You know, we're talking about this free program. What's the advantage, or what are the advantages of hiring somebody like yourself or anybody else to do your taxes?
Well, Larry, I think that's a great question. I think the idea is, first of all, people in the tax profession, I would hope, are up to date on the things that are going on in the tax law, in the changes, in the ideas for it. Filling out a tax form is not an overly difficult thing if you know the rules. But to learn the rules takes a lot of time, and for some people, it's more time consuming than they want. I think a lot of the tax, and I say professionals, offer other things like guidance, like helping determine what the tax consequences in the future of retiring and your Social Security being come taxable and what it does to your other income, and just the guidance that can go along with it. Also, the fact that there is somebody that if you get the IRS letter, the state letter, there's somebody to help interpret that. IRS and is not without making mistakes, and people get very concerned when they get an IRS letter. And working with a professional, you have someone to ask to be with you, so to speak, if those things come up.
And by the way, they're not going to call you, I don't think. You're going to get a letter from the IRS.
I think what you're talking about is scams.
Yeah.
There are a lot of scams. And IRS does not call you and say, you owe me taxes. Go to the local Quick Trip and take out a card and send us gift cards or whatever. Because those are some of the things that the scammers have asked for. IRS communicates with people by letter. If you're in the midst of an audit or something like that, you may be communicating with the particular auditor in a different way, maybe email, maybe phone conversations. But that's an unusual part of it, not the norm. So if people get calls or get emails or anything like that that you don't think is the IRS, then don't respond in that way. Check it out. Call the IRS. I know it's hard to get in to talk to the IRS, but before you just send money or do something silly, you need to have, at the very least, a second opinion. And there is an interesting thing at the IRS website. The IRS puts together what's called a Dirty Dozen list, and every year for many, many, many years, they've been putting together this Dirty Dozen list, and it is the bad things that they see in the tax world. And there's two this year that have to do with identity theft, phishing, and it's not the one that you do with the bait and pole, it's the PH. And there are even a couple of different terms that reflect the fact that there are bad people out there that are trying different ways to get your financial information so that they can profit from it.
Yeah. Daniel emailed us. His teenager got a job this year for the first time, wondering if she will have to pay taxes. What's the minimum amount you need to earn before you need to file?
The minimum amount is the standard deduction for this year, and that number is around $15,000. Everyone is entitled to a standard deduction, and as long as your income is below the standard deduction, which is approximately $15,000 this year, as long as you're below that and the money is not from self-employment income, because the levels are a little different for that. But as long as the money is not from that, then if she's under that amount, she doesn't need to file.
And then as the parents, could they claim her as an a deduction?
Dependency rules are different. For a child, and I assume this child is under the age of 19, dependency rules say a parent is eligible to claim the child if they're under the age of 19 or under the age of 24 and a full-time student for at least 5 months out of the year. There are other criteria with it. A lot of times parents know the word support, and you can claim a dependent if you've paid more than half their support. That's, again, only one of several tests. But when the child is under 19 or under 24 and a full-time student, the support test isn't mom and dad paying for their support. It's the child not paying more than half of their own support. So if the child makes, well, let's say the child made $12,000. We'll just use that as a number. For the child, first of all, the child would have had to spend all of the money. And if it costs more than double that, more than $24,000 to raise that child, then mom and dad could claim that child without any problem. Rarely do the kids' jobs add up to enough money that they are supporting themselves. If they put the money in savings, it doesn't count towards their support. So again, in the years where it gets a little dicey in deciding dependency, that's the times that having tax professionals help you out with making those decisions. And when the child goes to college and has student loans and has things like that, it gets even more complicated.
Yeah, for sure. Kurt in Watertown called, couldn't stay with us. Kurt plans to take a federal clean energy tax credit and wonders if Wisconsin offers an equivalent tax credit for energy efficient home improvements.
The answer to that is no. Wisconsin at this point does not offer any energy credits. Now, again, sometimes there's other credits that are not tax-based credits that might apply to some of those things that are also not the federal energy credits. So there could be, years ago it was something called Focus on Energy, and it applied to the specific item that you were putting in. But the state of Wisconsin itself does not offer a tax credit for it.
Michael emailed with a question, but before we get to that, I want to get to Rick in Belleville, who has a question. Rick, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Mary. I have three questions I'll throw at you, Mary, and I can listen to the answer once I hang up. First question is, if you do 1031 exchanges on properties and you've deferred capital gains by doing exchanges, several of them maybe in a row, my understanding is if you die and someone inherits that property, that they're not responsible for that capital gain that you've made. That's the first question. Second question is, your fees when you do tax preparation, I'm understanding now, are currently not deductible on my taxes, and what you think the current status of that is and what you think the future is going to hold for whether your fees are going to be deductible or not. And the third one is the inheritance tax, the death tax. I think it's up to $12 million you can pass on and not be taxed, and that expires. And what you think is going to happen with the expiration of that in 2025. I appreciate your expertise in all these things. You do a great job. Thank you.
Well, Rick has three very interesting questions. So the first one, the like-kind exchange, just to kind of backdrop what he's talking about. If I have business or investment property, I can exchange it with another property. There are conditions with it, and not recognize the gain on the sale of the first property. The reason I don't recognize it is the cost basis of that lower property becomes the cost basis of the new property. So the gain kind of accumulates. It's a little bit like the sale of a principal residence was years ago. But this kind of accumulates. And his question is, if I die and I have this property that has a really low basis because of all the like-kind exchanges, will my heirs have to pay taxes on that gain? And the answer is no, because when you die, the property that you have, and again, it's not the income in respect of a decedent. This doesn't work for pensions and IRAs. But the property you have is revalued at the date of death at its fair market value. Usually that's higher than the cost basis, especially in our recent real estate market. But it's revalued, and the person that inherits it starts out with a new basis going forward. And if your basis is very low, the revalued number is higher. And if they were to turn around and sell it at that point, there wouldn't be any gain to pay on it. So that's question number one. I hope that
good answer.
Question number two has to do with tax preparation fees. Now, the tax preparation fees for personal tax returns were deductible in the past as a 2% itemized deduction. So first of all, you have to itemize, and then all of your miscellaneous itemized deductions had to exceed 2% of your adjusted gross income. Back in the 2017 TCJA Act, the Congress did away with miscellaneous itemized deductions subject to 2%. That's where the tax prep for the personal returns went. Now, that being said, not all tax prep fees are non-deductible. If you have business, if you have rental, the allocation of the deductions for preparations of those returns are still deductible because they don't go through a Schedule A. They go directly to that endeavor, so to speak. Do I think it's going to come back? Well, CGIA, for the personal side of the deductions, pretty much, is supposed to be done at the end of 2025. Meaning, if things are not extended or kept from that bill, we're all going to probably pay more taxes. Because one of the major things in that bill is the standard deduction. The standard deduction is about $30,000 for a married couple. If that went away, it would go back to the 2017 numbers, which would be about half of that. That means that there's a lot of people that are going to have to itemize again and not use standard deduction. And itemizing is not always better for you. Do I think it's going to go back? To be honest, I don't think it's going to go back, but who knows what Congress will do at that point. But part of that bill also took away miscellaneous itemized deductions. Remember when, if you were an employee, you could take the mileage on your business use of your employee vehicle. That went away with it as well. If they reinstated the 2017 rules, that would come back too. I really don't think Congress or IRS is thrilled with that one. But he's, yes. We'll see what happens in the next couple of years, because a decision is going to have to be made or extenders done until they do make a decision. And then that brings me to the third question. What about the inheritance tax? Inheritance tax that Rick was talking about is the value of your property. When someone dies, you add up the fair market value of all your property, and if it is over the 13, I believe it's 13 million this year. Again, I don't memorize the numbers. When I need them, I find them at that exact time. It's somewhere in the 13 million range. A lot of people do not get anywhere near that range. It is certainly, there are people that pay estate tax because the value of all of their assets are over that 13 million. Do I think it's going to go down? There's been a lot of speculation of readjusting it, maybe back to the prior years. And if they readjusted it, the talk is going back to 5 million. There would be more people affected at 5 million than 13 million. But it's only a guess of what Congress really will end up doing.
Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, her business. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow at this time, we'll listen to new Christmas music with author and podcaster Tom Wilmoth. Then at noon, Santa Claus and Elf Jingle will be here taking last-minute gift requests from children. So if you have some children or grandchildren visiting, have them give a call to the program tomorrow after 12 o'clock, and Santa will be there to answer and talk with that child. So I hope you'll do that. It's always a lot of fun. Vera in Dowsman has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vera.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guest knows how to contact ARP to get a time slot for having your taxes done.
No, I'm sorry. I have no idea. Maybe if you contacted the place where they are in our community, the village, the community center is where the VITA programs are run, and they may be able to tell you something. It's not anything that I have knowledge of.
Yeah. So there, or maybe even your local library, Vera, would have that information as well. Be another opportunity, I think, to check with the local library on it. Elaine in Janesville called, couldn't stay with us. It wants to know if a child has to file for a tax refund if federal and state taxes have been withheld from their paychecks. And we're probably looking at somebody who, a child who made a small amount of money but had the taxes taken out.
That's a really good question. If you have taxes taken out and you don't owe tax, the only way to get that money back is to file a tax return and get the refund. But it's probably important to take a look at what the kids did on their W-4, how they filled out their W-4. The current version of the W-4, if you check the box single and don't do anything else on the form other than sign the form, they will take out the proper amount that you would have to pay on that income if that were your only income. And for students, that's often the way it is. So if they have money taken out, I'm not sure if they make a lot more money or what it is, but a lot of the young people today don't have withholding because of the way the W-4 is filled out.
Michael emailed with questions about moving 529 funds to a Roth IRA. Can 529 money only fund the child's Roth IRA, or can it go to the owner's Roth IRA?
Beneficiary, not. The only way it would go to the owner is if the owner were the beneficiary of the account. So if it's a parent or a grandparent setting up an account for a child, it could only go to the child. And there are, as I mentioned, the 15 years. Check it out before you just automatically move the money.
Yeah. And is the amount that can be moved to the Roth limited to the yearly contribution?
I do not believe that to be the case. But again, I'd have to check it out to know exactly the set of rules.
Yeah. Virginia emails. She wants to know if it ever makes sense to claim medical and dental expenses as itemized deductions if her and her family have been relatively healthy through the year. She says she doesn't want to keep track of all the small copay receipts through the year.
Well, remember that there, with medical deductions, there are two things that you have to do first of all. First of all, to have anything to deduct medically, your expenses have to be more than 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Then after that, you have to be able to itemize your deductions collectively. And again, for a married couple this year, it's $29,200 is the standard deduction. So I hate to tell someone not to save them, because if you throw away the ones early and something bad happens at the end, you may find yourself at that spot. I would recommend you just save the receipts, throw them in an envelope, and if something big happens at the end, then you start putting them together. Otherwise, you're taking the risk of maybe not having them when you need it. Not a lot of people are eligible to do it. It usually happens when there's been some kind of catastrophic illness, maybe not good insurance coverage, or you find yourself in an assisted living or a nursing home situation where the costs are very expensive and out of the pocket.
Jim has a house worth $700,000, wants to move to a smaller place, and maybe the $400,000 range, just because. Is he going to have to pay taxes on that difference between what he sells the house for and what he pays for the next one?
If this is Jim's principal residence, there is an exclusion, what we call a 121 exclusion. And the 121 exclusion says if you have owned and occupied that house for more than 2 years as your principal residence and you sell the home, you may be able to exclude $250,000 of the gain. Now, Jim told us what his house was worth. He didn't tell us what he paid for it or what he has invested in it. That you need to know, because the difference, that gain, is what you compare to the $250,000. And if it is a married couple and they meet $500,000.
Mary Mellum will be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk taxes with her. And I hope you'll join in with your own tax questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. We'll be back with Mary right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking taxes today with Green Bay area tax professional Mary Mellum. Mary and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. Great to have her back with us. And if you have a tax question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call from Arlene in Madison. Hi, Arlene.
Hello. I'm really glad to have a chance to ask the question. And I realize I'm in your second hour, so maybe it has been asked and answered. My question is, I'm 84. I'm widowed. A single tax return, but for the last 5 years or so, when I've filed taxes, they don't owe me anything. I don't owe them anything. And so it's been suggested to me that I don't need to file taxes anymore. Do I?
It depends on, it's a good question. It depends on why you don't owe any taxes, or you don't owe any, they don't owe any. Is it because when you get to the bottom of the front page, it's already zero, which means you're under the standard deduction? Or does it mean that your tax and your withholding are equal, or your tax and your credits are equal? So if you have less income subject to tax than the standard deduction, you don't have to file. If you're using a credit to pay the tax that makes you have nothing owed, nothing getting back, that's a different story. So it depends on why, you know, why they're telling you you might not need to file.
Okay. Arlene, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mark and De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, hi there. Thank you for having this very interesting program today. I am 67, lost my job in June, now dependent only on Social Security. I owe about $10,000 in federal tax obligations over the last 10 years. I keep getting offers in the mail and online offering to settle my tax debt with the IRS. My question number one is, are any of these legitimate? My second question is, I have sent in a couple times an offer in what's called an offer in compromise to the IRS. And so far, I don't have an answer even after several months. Is that legitimate also?
Okay, they're both really good questions. The first one is there a way to deal with the IRS? The answer is yes. Are there companies that are legitimate? Yes. Are there companies that are shams? Yes. You know, if you literally hear, you know, we can settle your tax debts for pennies on the dollar, be careful, because number one, that sounds too good to be true, and it might be. Is the IRS willing to settle debt? Yes, in certain cases. Your offer in compromise is a good way to go. It depends. It takes a while to work with the IRS. Have you gotten any communication from it after you sent it in, like, we received it, give us more time, or something like that?
No, nothing like that.
Did you send any payment? Did you ask for everything to be forgiven, or were you willing to make a deal?
I was willing to make a deal.
Did you send an equivalent of one payment of that deal with it?
No, I didn't.
Okay. if you did the offer and compromise yourself, I would recommend that you go back and look at the conditions. I believe that one of the conditions is if you make an offer, you have to make one payment with it, kind of like good faith, and that kind of gives them something to look at. I'm a little surprised that they haven't either rejected the offer or communicated with you. It might be a timing thing. Things at the IRS move slowly. So I would look back into it. Just because you go to one of the places that offers that, first of all, you're going to have to pay money to them. They don't do it for free. And can they do something magical? I don't think that any of the companies have any magic. However, they might know things that you as a general person don't, or ways to, you know, questions to ask you and things like that. So I would probably look into my offer and compromise, and I'd probably try to contact the IRS about it, and maybe you can find out what's taking so long by doing that before you go into paying someone else to look into the situation.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Mark, good luck. Thank you. Deanna in Belgium, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Deanna.
Hi, Larry. Glad to hear you. Thank you for the show. This was very well timing.
What's on your mind?
My daughter, who's a minor, she's 17, inherited some assets and some money from her father. And her father was deceased in August of this year. I would like to know if my daughter is a minor, does she have to pay any taxes on the money that she inherited from her father? Or...
Okay.
Deanna, it depends on what sources that money came from. If he was working and she was the heir of his pension plan, there will be some tax consequences. If he had an IRA and she got the money distributed out of the IRA, that could be tax consequences. If she got a bank account or investments like mutual funds or dividends, the inheritance of those things is not taxable, nor the inheritance of personal property or real estate. The earnings that they make after she inherits it, of course, will be taxable.
Deanna, there you go. Appreciate your call very much. Neil in Winona, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Neil.
Hi, hello. Good afternoon. So I'm getting ready to retire in a couple of years. We want to do some traveling in retirement. And I'm looking to buy a vehicle to pull around an RV, a camper with. And my thought process is, well, first of all, I know very little about doing taxes. I use TurboTax to do my taxes. I always have, but that's about the extent of my knowledge. So I'm looking to buy this piece of equipment. And my thought process is there a benefit of buying it now and starting up some sort of a business to get a tax break or tax write-off on buying that piece of equipment now? Or am I better off just waiting till the time comes and buying that piece of equipment and putting it into recreational use?
Well, Neil, if you are creating a business just so you can use this piece of equipment, I'm not sure how productive that would be. And even if you're able to write off of it with your business, when you eventually sell it, you'll recapture that deduction that you took. So the legitimacy to me of doing that would have to be dependent on the real legitimacy of using that kind of a vehicle in a business. I guess I would err on when you need it, you buy it, and not worry about the business side if it means creating a business just to do that.
Okay. Neil, there you go. Thank you for calling. Lee emailed to ask if grandparents contribute to a grandchild's 529, can that contribution be deducted from the grandparents' taxable income?
The 529 in general has no deduction for federal purposes. If you are a Wisconsin resident and put it in an EdVest or Tomorrow Scholar, the Wisconsin contribution is deductible on the Wisconsin return.
All right, that makes sense. Helen emailed to say they've been approved for a WIDA grant for low-income homeowners. Amounts to $50,000 for home repairs. Helen is being asked to sign a mortgage, which will be forgiven if they live in the home for 5 years. How can Helen know what the tax consequences are?
Well, if there is forgiveness of debt, and the forgiveness of debt is taxable income, if that's the case, unless there is a special program that excludes it. If I were her, I would be asking them, would this forgiveness of debt be tax exempt? There are some times when debt forgiveness is not taxable, but generally it is. And if it is, it's adding, if it were $50,000, adding $50,000 onto your income. So you need to find out what kind of a grant it is, whether it's non-taxable or taxable.
Ellen emailed to say they sold a non-primary residence in 2024. Are capital gains based upon sale price minus all agent, title, other fees, you know, the buyer pays? And also, are expenses related to improvements to property deductible, and under what schedule?
Okay. First of all, I'm assuming it's something like a second home, a vacation home. The gain from the sale is taxable on a vacation home. You have your gross proceeds, and you do get to reduce those by your investment in your house. And that would be what you paid for it, the capital improvements made to it, things like renovating, putting on a new roof, maybe putting in a driveway, something like that. Your normal paints and upkeep maintenance is not part of that. And then when it comes to the fees that the seller pays that are cost of selling the property, like the brokerage commission, like the title insurance, different recording fees, those are all deductible against that gain.
This is interesting. Jenna emailed to say they withdrew money. Jenna withdrew money from a retirement account. She's 68 years old. And she and her husband filed jointly, wondering if there's a way she can keep her withdrawal confidential so the husband doesn't learn about the withdrawal. Can Jenna file that part on her own rather than on the joint filing?
Well, Jenna, if you jointly file a return, unless your husband is asleep, he should know that there is a 1099-R that goes along with it. If you live in Wisconsin, filing separate would not even keep it secret because we are a marital property state. So if you file separately, half of your income and half his income go on your return and half equivalent on the other return. So my advice is fess up and tell him.
Okay. Shar emailed to say they got an estimate on housework that is much higher than expected. Would Shar pay less by taking money from their annuity and any taxes on it, or take out a loan through the roofer? The annuity is variable and non-qualified. She's 74 years old, but does not take out annual distributions from the annuity.
Well, it depends on what the consequences of taking the money out of the annuity. If it's in the term before it's annuitized, if she can get the money out, it's going to be interest first that comes out. So whatever she takes out is going to be taxable income to her, if she can do that, based on the rules of the annuity. If she takes a loan from the roofer, it depends on the interest rate that she's going to be charged for that roof. And chances are that's not going to be, either she has to itemize if it's a lien on her property for an improvement. Otherwise, you know, the interest is lost. So she needs to, there isn't an easy answer to it. She needs to look at the annuity to whether she can get the money out, and the if she has interest first and she took out $50,000, whatever her tax rate would be to add that on, compare that to what the interest rate that they might charge her on it.
The Corporate Transparency Act, that was enacted in 2021, and it's meant to identify people who own companies and eliminate fraud and illegal activity. So what does this federal law require business owners to do?
There is, well, let me tell you first of what it is, and what you did say about it. That was Congress's way of uncovering people that are laundering money and creating multiple corporations that just pass through, don't really exist for any reason, and keep identity secret. But the bottom line is there is a criteria of people that are in business that have to or that are required to do this. Now, if anybody has a business that registers their business with the Secretary of State, that would be in corporations or LLCs primarily. And there are, I mean, there are many rules with it, but if you have a business that has LLC behind its name or INC and you had set it up through the Secretary of State, you are potentially required to do this. And why it's important now is because it was December 31st for an existing business, one that didn't start initially in 24. That was the date to go online to FinCEN.gov, and that's the same one for foreign investments. And you would register as a part of that. Now, here's, if you go to the FinCEN.gov, what you're going to see at that site currently is it says that there has been a court case, it's called Texas Top Cop versus Garland, that questioned the constitutionality of this registration. The registration does not cost any money. If you go to somewhere and it's costing you money, you're in the wrong place. But at this point, it's put on hold until whenever the appeal comes out. The important part is this is meant for all businesses that have that criteria. And my concern was some people have rental property that they organize under an LLC. Some people have a small business that is under an LLC. Those people were required prior to this court case, which is kind of has everything hanging in the air, they were required to go to FinCEN.gov and register your business. And if they didn't, there were substantial fines that went along with it. So right now, the December 31st date isn't as earth-shattering as it might have been just because of this court case. But if the court case is settled or something goes along, it could change the rule back to needing to report.
Got it. Ed in Lodi has a question. Hi, Ed.
I had a question about tax incentives or rebates for installing energy efficient air conditioner and furnace. We had to do that this year. I found a form 5695, and I don't know if that applies or not.
5695 is the energy credit form. And if you install the one that matches the credit requirements, it is possible to benefit from the energy credits. There is, I believe it's a 30% credit. There is a maximum that goes with it, but you need to go back to the person that the vendor and make sure it qualifies for the energy credit first. I believe it has to be, in terms of the furnace, it had to be 96% efficient to qualify for it. The old credit was 95% efficient. So the 5695 would be the form that you would use if you have qualified products that you did install.
All right, Ed, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And Mary, on that note, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us together, and you'll be back with us, I hope, and do this again?
Yes, I believe in January.
Oh, perfect. All right. Thank you so much. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, been in the tax business for more than 30 years. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. And she knows a whole lot about taxes, that's for sure. Coming up, we'll talk about adult life skills being taught in classrooms with Amanda Cosman, a Walworth County-based family living educator with UW Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. It's great to have you with us as we talk a little bit about those everyday skills. Not everybody reaches adulthood knowing how to cook, for example, or be familiar with their rights as renters, or maybe how to maintain productive workplace relationship. Adulting kind of has to be learned. And fortunately for us, there are people out there teaching those necessary everyday skills. Amanda Cosman is one of them, a family living educator with UW-Madison's Division of Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute. She teaches classes in Walworth County for high school students and adults on independent living, on financial capability, and on health and well-being. So as we talk with Amanda, I hope you'll join in. Would you take or have your teenage children take classes on how to manage money or maybe develop healthy eating and exercise habits? What life skills do you wish you'd learned in high school? There were a few I wish I'd learned. I know that for sure. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear your experiences. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Amanda Cosman, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, you've been an extension educator for some 20 years, and now you're with extension in the Human Development Relationships Institute.
Yes, I am. I'm enjoying my time in that institute now. I used to be in youth development as well.
So you've had, and what is the institute? I mean, it sounds like it covers a broad area.
Oh, yeah, it's very broad. We have, for the human development relationships, we talk about family relationships. And then we also will talk about aging, so that in that other end of the spectrum. So we'll talk about aging populations. And I really focus my time in the financial area. But of course, you know, we know that finances don't happen in a vacuum. So, you know, I'm always touching a variety of different areas of young people and even dabbling in the Health and Wellbeing Institute to help bring some of that stuff in as well.
Has this changed? You've been doing this for 20 years. Has this changed a lot over the years in your mind?
Well, things have changed so much in 20 years, and myself included. as I grow older, I get more wisdom. And so in my extension careers, I started out wanting to be a 4-H educator, and I love 4-H. But as I worked with juvenile justice programs, with the teen court program, I started to really realize that parents and finances really play a huge role in people's lives and some of these skills. So really through that juvenile justice and helping people develop these skills and this communication style would really be helpful. So that's when I made the transition to the human development and relationships area, because I really wanted to start helping kids before they started getting into trouble and helping families before they got into trouble.
I was thinking back, as you mentioned, you were involved in 4-H. Actually, a lot of things I learned, even managing money, because I had a calf, you know, showed calves, and you had to fill out all of these forms and keep track of expenses. And I took a cooking project, and had a whole variety of other projects, and 4-H was actually pretty darn helpful.
I 100% agree. I still volunteer with 4-H. I had rabbits and pigs, and those forms really were, I think, the key to my money management success and what gave me interest in that at a young age.
Well, I had rabbits, too. I forgot about the rabbits. And an electricity project and leathercraft and, just a whole gamut. Well, let's forget it. Enough about me. Let's turn. So the settings for this, you teach high school students and adults in Walworth County. What kind of settings do you like, do you work in or like to work in?
Well, I like to work where I can meet people where they're at. So where I can reach the people the most effectively. So sometimes that might be in a homeless shelter. Sometimes that might be in the high school classroom. Sometimes they'll come to me and meet in my building for a class during the day. Sometimes it's at the Health and Human Services with kids who are placed outside the home through social services. This could be anywhere where people gather. This could be a library, and they're comfortable enough to really learn. So it really depends on who my target audience might be, where they're most comfortable, where I can make it most convenient for them to learn. And we do a lot of offsite stuff with our independent living as well, if possible. So sometimes we're meeting in some of our partners' places so that they can kind of get to know where the services are and feel comfortable accessing those services.
Yeah. So you're in Walworth County. Can these classes be taken in other Wisconsin counties?
Absolutely. So we have educators in most of the 72 counties in Wisconsin. And so we have educators that will work towards that. So sometimes they are 4-H educators or youth development educators. Sometimes they're going to be from the Human Development Relationships Institute. So these can be people all over the state of Wisconsin. Not all counties offer this kind of program, but many counties do.
And I'm wondering if there must be, or maybe not, are there efforts among them to share experience and resources?
Absolutely. In Extension, we really love the Wisconsin idea. So we're trying to bring the university resources to where people live, work, and play. And so one of the things we're doing is, since I've been teaching this program in some shape or form and for probably 20 years, although it's evolved over time, we're going to be putting together a curriculum for people to work with young people. We're calling it independent living skills. It is focused primarily on youth that are placed outside the home through social services, but it's going to be really applicable to anybody. And the people can take this curriculum. We're in the process of writing it, so it's not available yet. But we're going to actually be able to have people take that and apply it to the populations they're working with. We're going to make sure it's flexible so that people can meet the needs of their audiences where they are. And we're going to hopefully, you know, be able to replicate that and train trainers to be able to use it as well.
So you have, as we've been talking here, you're interested in teach financial literacy, but there's also health and independent living for high school students and adults. How do you determine the information that people need the most?
Well, we've done some focus groups with our population. So we really talked to them about what things do they need, what things do they need to be successful, what information do they need, what things make them most comfortable in doing that. So we've talked to those focus groups. We've also worked with caseworkers and school staff to find out what things they think their students need. And I've also worked with in the past young people who are, you know, in that early 20s. What things do they wish they would have known when they were, you know, starting out on their independent life when they were doing that? And so we've been putting and compiling these things. There's some things that are core to this, being an informed renter, making sure your home is clean. But we also have other modules that I give in my class at the beginning, kind of a survey of what things do you want to know? What things do you need to know? What are your goals? So sometimes I will be teaching a class and we will go to the laundromat and learn how to do laundry. But if every kid in my class or most of the kids already know how to do laundry, I'm not going to focus time on that. I might take them to a car dealership and find out, how do you buy a car? And how do you work through that process? How do you get a loan? How are you loan worthy? How are you able to make those payments? What happens if you can't make that loan? So that they are successful as adults. So really, these skills, it could be things about healthy relationships. It could be eating healthy meals and how to go grocery shopping on a budget and working through all of those different skills that people need as an adult to be successful, and really meeting those young people where they need to increase those skills to feel confident moving into their adult life.
Do you invite... from time to time, or maybe I should say, when do you invite professionals from the community? I think that could be a good learning experience, maybe for the professionals you bring in as well. But I think it'd be useful to have a situation like that, where you've got people from the community who can come in and talk as well.
We do that all the time. So when I talk about legal issues, we have an attorney from Walworth County that comes in and does a great job talking to kids, not just about rental things, but when you're signing a lease, what things you need to look for, if you're pulled over, if you ever go to court, how to retain an attorney, all those kind of different things. So we bring in an attorney. When we are talking about healthcare, we bring in somebody from the healthcare field. They talk about insurance, how to use it, how to get it, what things you need to bring to the doctor, how do you have a good conversation with your doctor, what things do you have to note. And so we actually embed this in the program as we go, so that not only are the youth learning the information they might need, but also so they have a positive connection and can talk to the actual provider so they feel more comfortable having those conversations as they grow up. Because our young people have told us that they're afraid to be unsuccessful. So that sometimes holds them back from making the call. So this way, if we can have somebody who's actually in the profession, give the kids the opportunity to really hear from them what they need to hear from them, so they feel more prepared to have those conversations. So, and we also want to make sure the kids get a positive connection and feel comfortable with those people.
Pretty cool. We're talking with Amanda Kosman, family living educator in Walworth County for UW Extension's Human Development and Relationship Institute. Questions for her, I hope you'll give a call or maybe an experience to share. I'd love to hear from you. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll be listening at 11 o'clock. We'll be listening to some new Christmas music. Author and podcaster Tom Wilmoth comes by a couple times a year to talk about music, usually summertime and then around the Christmas time. And it's always a lot of fun. We'll be playing a lot of songs. But then at noon, none other than Santa Claus and Jingle the Elf will be here taking calls from children. And if you have a child or grandchild or children around with you tomorrow from noon to one, I hope you'll call in or have the kids call in. It's got to be, you know, you can call, but then let the kids do the talking and tell Santa what they want for Christmas. That's kind of one of the fun shows of the year for us, and I always look forward to it. Right now, Amanda Kosman's visiting with us, family living educator with UW Extension, works out of Walworth County, works a lot with high school students and adults. She zeroes in a little on financial capability, but I'm sure independent living and maybe even health and well-being come into play as part of the work that she does. And love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. John sent a note. Where can we find out information on what adulting classes are available?
Well, you can always go to, of course, our website. If you Google UW Extension Financial Education, there's a variety of programs that you can go ahead and see. So we have some for end users, so people who want the information for themselves. And we also have some for professionals to work towards. So if you're a helping professional or volunteer, there's a lot of professional development. Some of my favorites are financial coaching. And like you said just earlier, finances, you know, that's what I focus on, and it says it's financial coaching, but there's sometimes we just focus on communication skills, having healthy boundaries with people and stuff like that. So, you know, it all goes together with finances. So we can do financial coaching on the website. We have a program called Planning Ahead, which helps people plan as they age for either, you know, retirement and beyond. So even end of life for themselves or for their loved ones, and helps them be prepared. That's 7 parts long. So we really do delve deep into it. We have Rent Smart, of course, which is my baby. I'm one of the co-chairs for that one at the state level. And so that one really talks and focuses on making sure people are informed renters and make sure that they have all the information they need. Although I say a lot of landlords actually attend as well to get that information. It really is helpful to making sure that they have the best experience possible when they're going to be doing that. We also have things like Money Smart and Head Start. So it helps parents to talk to their kids about finances from a young age in a positive way so that they learn those positive you know, developmentally appropriate skills so the kids can grow up being good at finances. We also have something called Money Matters, which are kind of the basics of finance, but are online so they can do it kind of as they would like to do that. There's so many programs that we offer in so many different ways. I really encourage going to the website and finding out what program you're interested in.
That makes a lot of sense. I was thinking back, it's been what, maybe a year or nearly a year ago, Wisconsin started requiring that high school graduates have a half credit of personal finance literacy. I think that's starting with the class of 2028.
Yeah, I'm so glad that they're doing that. So many of our young people say that they don't have the skills or they don't feel prepared in finances to be able to manage their money in a positive manner. So I'm really glad that they enacted that. It is up to the schools and how they want to incorporate that. And they really know their students best. So they've been incorporating ways that I think are meaningful for their students.
Yeah. How flexible is the financial literacy curriculum for Wisconsin high school students?
I don't think there's an actual curriculum. I believe that a lot of times the schools are looking for curriculums on their own. So some of the times we've had teachers show up to like our Rent Smart. So I said that it was a great class for renters, but we actually have a train the trainer. So teachers could come on and learn how to be a Rent Smart facilitator, and that would give them the curriculum they need. So they really can talk about, depending on the class, what is most appropriate for their classroom and their students.
Do you help parents talk to their kids about financial matters?
Absolutely. I love it. We have Money As You Grow for those young kids. But when I'm coaching, actually, I would say almost every parent wants to ask me a question about how do I talk to my kids about this? And so financial coaching, we really delve into some of the ways that they can work towards having those financial conversations. That's another program we have for volunteers and adults. It's called Encouraging Financial Conversations. Parents can go to that too, of course. And that really helps them have positive conversations because so many times kids, young adults, all they hear is no, and finances are something that limits them. And so this is how can you have positive financial conversations and teach them the positive skills they have, not just, oh, we don't have enough money, and, you know, making them feel like money is a bad thing or a dirty word.
Yeah, I can remember instances of, no, we can't afford that, or don't ask again, things of that nature. I've probably been on both the giving and receiving ends of those kinds of discussions, to be perfectly honest. Paul in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi. How do you negotiate with the landlord not to keep raising the rent, if possible?
So in our Rent Smart curriculum, we would talk about positive communications in that. And I would actually have to look at your lease to see when can they raise their rent. If you're on a month-to-month lease, that can be lease. It could happen way more often. And you also have to think about, is it a year lease, a six-month lease? And so it can only be done at the end of your term of your contract. So that's one of the things you want to talk about. But also having that open line of conversation and that positive relationship is really important as well, and making sure that you're having the conversation in a way that your listener, which would be the landlord, is receiving the message and helping to engage in solution building for you and helping engaging that them in that positive way. It's a long answer, and I don't think we have enough time to do that, and I wish I could, but I would really encourage you to actually send me an email and we can talk about that. Or if you'd like to join our Rent Smart, you are more than welcome. It is free, and we offer it monthly starting in February because January is that train the trainer for professionals and volunteers. But February, we'll start with the end user one all over again, and we have all these discussions. And that's 6 hours long, so it's quite a bit of time that we have to discuss that.
So just so I understand it, people who own the property can only ask for increases when the contract is about up.
Yes, at the end of the lease.
At the end of the lease. And that is true even if somebody buys the property and then wants to raise the rates right away?
The lease is the lease until that time. And so they can do that. Now, there are some things they can do. So there are some steps they can take. So don't take that as, you know, there's always an exception to the rule. So don't, you know, hold me to that 100%. But in standard terms, they have to follow the lease provisions until the end of the lease.
What? Tell us more about the RentSmart program you've got.
Well, the RentSmart program, we go through a whole bunch of things. We talk about, can you afford it? Positive communication, how to see any red flags, how to protect yourself from losing money. That might be at the end of the lease. It might be increases. It might be signing a longer lease so they can't increase it too many times, for example. This could be making sure that you're having positive, like starting the conversation in a way that you're engaging them to help you with an issue that you might be having versus coming back at it at a combative way. We talk about, choosing apartments in a way that you can, how to have those conversations with your partner if you're going to be living with somebody to make sure it meets the most of your needs so you don't have to move out in a year because it doesn't meet your needs. We talk about interviewing your landlord as much as they're interviewing you so that you can make sure that this is a landlord that you feel comfortable living with. We go through a full gamut. It is 6 hours long. We even go through a lease specifically in detail through a scavenger hunt to make it fun because we always, you know, we don't like talking at people. So we always have a lot of activities to make things fun as we can make them. And so that people really get an understanding of what Wisconsin laws are around this and they can protect themselves and make sure that they are probably the best renter they possibly can, because information and knowing these things is super important. A lot of my clients might not know what they're supposed to do, and that makes it harder for the landlord and the tenant.
An email here, are the majority of these programs in person? Are there programs that are offered via Google Meet, for example, or, you know, something like that?
Or a lot Zoom. Of our programs are there. Yep, they're via, we do Zoom. So RentSmart, we do almost monthly. So January and July, we don't have the end user program, but we have train the trainer programs. So that happens monthly, and that's all via Zoom. I teach my programs when I go to the high school, to the homeless shelter, are all in person. So it really depends if your county has a financial educator in it, like myself. If we do, then you likely would have some of those programs in person. But if you don't, then you can always access some of those programs online via Zoom. And so we do offer a variety of different options for people to meet their needs and make sure that, you know, the information gets out there, because it does no good sitting on my shelf.
How often do you work with people who are court ordered to learn the skills you teach? Does that ever happen?
Oh, yes. When I was a 4-H educator, I worked with that youth court program I told you guys about, and I had to teach a success skills class. So this is the precursor for kids that was either me or lockup. It also was a sanction for kids that went through teen court if they felt like they needed some of these success skills. So, you know, it was more a positive spin on life skills or independent living. It was being successful in life. So that was one of them. We do have people that are court ordered to come into the RentSmart program, either virtually or not. We also have housing authorities in the state who will grant 1 year positive rental history to those who complete the RentSmart program. And there are landlords who know what the RentSmart curriculum is, so they might do that. So there's a variety of ways people are encouraged to attend the programs, whether it be court ordered, incentivized, or just because they want to be successful in their rental lives. And I would say they might come in a little bit, like, especially if they're court ordered, like, I don't want to do this, I just have to check a box. But I will say those people usually leave going, I really didn't want to do this, but I get a lot of good information and thank you. So I'm really excited by, you know, the response. So we do have that. And they're like, I didn't want to be here, but they made me and I'm glad I was. So I'm so happy when that happens.
When you, and that's, I was going to ask you about examples of successes. Do you have some other personal anecdotes that you might relate to us?
I have young people who leave my independent living, who are youth that are placed outside the home through social services. They would be leaving my program on the last day. We do a little bit of a celebration. They're like, everybody should have to do this. Everybody should have to go through this class. I can't believe they don't make everybody do it. When we come out through the homeless shelter, I actually do a program where they get an incentive for doing a follow-up survey with me. And they, I get so many positive stories that people are really changing their lives and the way they, their relationship with money has changed, the way they manage money or the way they use it or have taken control of money has changed, the way they think about money has changed. They have better, more safe and stable housing. There are some studies or some surveys results on our website that talk, and those who are seeking new housing, I think it was in the 80% had found more safe and stable housing after going through the program. So we've got lots of positive outcomes that come from this program.
And again, where do we go to learn more about the program? I looked online, and it's pretty cool what you've got there, and pretty easy to use. But tell people how to get to that.
Well, the URL that I'd go is finances.extension.wisc.edu. But if you put in UW Extension Financial Programs, it'll come up too. So just to make it easier for you guys, because nobody wants a big URL.
No.
You can find that. You could also go to just the extension page and find things about parenting education. We have things about aging. So if you have aging parents, to help prepare them. This is right down to where are your passwords and where do you keep them and where do you keep the will and everything like that. We also have programming on mental health issues, and that's a big deal. We have parenting on eating health or curriculum on eating healthy. We have gardening curriculums. We have apple tree curriculums. I have apples. I can see them out my window. So I'm like, we have so many fun programs that can help people and engage them where they are and where they really want to go.
Amanda, it's been great fun talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get a chance to meet again and talk. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Amanda Kosman, a family living educator in Walworth County for UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller.